I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining me on the Mona Charon Show. This is a special episode, a little departure from our usual today. I have invited Jay Nordlinger, my dear friend of long standing. He is a political commentator, writer, also a music critic. He writes music criticism for the New Criterion, and over the years has really enhanced my appreciation for music. And we have fun discussing our various favorites. And so Jay has agreed to join us today to just do a little taste of various kinds of music with the idea that you'll either just enjoy it, or maybe if you're not used to this kind of music, which is sort of classical or concert music, that maybe you'll discover something that you like. So, Jay, thank you so much for joining me.
Mona, it's such a pleasure to see you on my screen here and talk with you. And feels like old times. And what the heck, you're one of my favorite people ever. What can I say?
Ditto. So you've prepared a few selections. And so what we're going to do is we're going to play them and then we'll talk about them. Or if you want to introduce the first one, please do.
Well, we have done musical programs before, you and I. And
yes.
You told me the other day, I really like Thomas Tallis, the Renaissance composer, the Englishman, and you were quite right to. So I thought, in your honor, would begin with a little motet by Tallis. It's from the Gospel of John, and it will be sung by the Cambridge Singers, conducted by John Rutter, who's well known as a composer as well. So this is Thomas Tallis from, I think, the 1560s. Speaking to us now and always.
Thank you.
Oh, lovely. And he died in his bed, which was not so typical for people at the court in those days, right?
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. If you could manage to do that, that was something. Yeah.
Jay,
and trying to compose music at the same time.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about you. So how old were you when you first began to love music?
I had a musical family, parents, grandparents, and it was always present like air. Always. Yeah.
Always. Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's next? That was the 1560s, you say? So
yeah, let me consult my... Oh, we're going to Bach. We're going to Johann Sebastian Bach and a violin piece. One of the most famous he ever wrote. It's from the Partita in E major. Instantly recognizable. It's the Preludio, the first movement, of course, of this suite or Partita. We're going to hear just some of it, maybe about half of it. I can't remember. And we'll hear it played by Hilary Hahn, age 17, when she recorded this. She was still a student at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Today she is in her mid-40s. And one of the greatest violinists, greatest instrumentalists, indeed greatest musicians of our time. But she was great already as a teenager at 17. And we will hear her and Bach, who have long made a wonderful combination.
Wow.
Sorry to cut it off, but that's...
Oh, my gosh. So I've...
That's what Bach could do, you know, with one instrument, not a piano, not a keyboard, not an organ, not a harpsichord, just those single notes with a little bit of doubling. Yeah.
You know, there are moments there where it sounds like it's got to be two people playing. It's so intricate and so hard. And I also, I mean, not only is she great, but that violin sounds like a really special instrument. Do you happen to know what she was playing?
Not specifically, but I can tell you about a funny exchange I had with a violinist I interviewed, Benjamin Schmidt, an Austrian. We were doing a little Q&A in front of an audience, and I said, he was playing, of course, a very good violin, and he explained to me what... I think he had his violin along, that I do remember. And I said, well, can a mediocre violinist get a good sound out of this? And he said, no. And I said, can a good violinist get a good sound out of a mediocre instrument? And he said, yes. And so, to use very politically incorrect language, it's not the arrow, it's the Indian. We used to say it about golf and golf clubs. You know, a good golfer, Jack Nicklaus, can use a broomstick. It'll turn out well. I can use the best club ever made. It's not going to turn out well.
Gotcha. So anyway, as somebody who in my adulthood decided to take up a string instrument, As I knew it would, it gave me a lifelong appreciation for string players, above and beyond what I had before, because it's so hard, and I just love the vibrating wood and how it sounds. It's just, I don't know, it's just.
And there's, bear in mind too, there's very little room on a violin, a very room, very little room in which to work, very little room to maneuver. A violist has more space, a cellist has more space yet, bassist and so on. But yeah, the violin really requires nimbleness.
Yeah. And when
Nimbleness,
you look
yeah.
at Itzhak Perlman playing, his hands are kind of big.
Meaty.
And you think, how does he do that on that tiny
Incredible. I could say
instrument?
the same as some pianist,
Yeah.
finesse.
Yeah.
Nikolai Petrov, the great burly Russian pianist, he had fingers like kielbasa's, and he was incredibly nimble.
Amazing. Okay, what else do you have for us?
Well, composers, Bach is sort of the father of us all when it comes to composition. This is not to say that Bach didn't have influences himself. It's not to say that he was newborn. He learned from others. But really, Bach founds modern music, modern Western classical music, and all subsequent composers have revered him, including Sergei Rachmaninoff, the great Russian who later became an American. And he paid tribute to Bach in a sense, by arranging the piece, the preludio for violin we just heard, for piano. He was not only a great composer, Rachmaninoff, he was one of the greatest pianists who ever lived. And he fashioned, it's important to say this, he fashioned really a new piece. This isn't a straight, faithful transcription from one instrument to another. This is what some people call Bach rock, Bach hyphen R-A-C-H, Bach and Rachmaninoff, Bach rock. And so you have, I would say, just off the top of my head, 70% Bach and 30% Rachmaninoff. It's a beautiful, ingenious blend. And we will hear this piece played by Hélène Grimaud, the French pianist. I've always called her La Belle Hélène, because there's an Offenbach operetta, I believe, La Belle Hélène, the beautiful Helen. And she is. And really an outstanding pianist, as we will hear. So here comes Bach Rock. This is really Rachmaninoff. Really Rachmaninoff here coming to the fore. This is Sergei, not JSB.
Thank you.
pure romanticism, pure romanticism. How about this modulation? How about this? How about this?
What an amazing blend of Baroque and Romantic. I mean, it's just incredible. It really works. I think that guy has a big future. I'll tell you, you know the whole genre of music videos that are like, you know, humorous, that are meant to be. Anyway, and there's like, in the spirit of Victor Borgia, who used to go around and perform on the piano and do these funny bits. I saw one that was a takeoff that was about Rachmaninoff, and it was this very small Asian pianist who, you know, starts talking to the audience and saying, you know, Rachmaninoff, great pianist. He had huge hands. And he said, and here are my hands. And he showed. So then he plays this Rachmaninoff piece, but he brings out one of those big rakes, you know, and he slams on the keyboard with the rake because to compensate for hand size. But apparently Rachmaninoff did have unusually large hands.
He certainly did. And he wrote his piano music for himself to concertize with. And so the stretches, the reaches are great. And the same is true of Brahms, by the way.
Is it? So just for the benefit of people who don't have musical training, what is a modulation?
Moving from one key to another in interesting harmonic ways.
Right.
Basically.
And it keeps the music interesting.
Often it does. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And no one ever did it better than Bach, from whom everyone else learned. By the way, Mona, just an aside, you know, sometimes on air, I talk to you the way we talk in private. And I just thought, if you don't know already, I know that you would like to know about Victor Borgia, that Borgia was his adopted last name. It was his original first name in Denmark. And he was Rosenbaum.
I did not know that.
And he escaped with his life.
And, wow.
And he sort of covered this for years with humor, with being jokey Victor Borgia. But you can find an interview or two with him in which he's dead serious.
Oh,
and
he
was a very interesting and brilliant man who survived to spread a lot of joy. So I'll just tell our listeners, this is the way Mona and I talk in private. And true, Mona?
So interesting. And by the way, I highly recommend anybody who is not familiar with his work, just pull him up on YouTube. I mean, he did these wonderful, silly, but delightful musical comedy things where he would sit down to play the piano, he'd fall off the bench, he would, you know, variously. But he was also quite a good pianist.
Very good musician. Yeah. Yeah. Who put his talents to comedic use.
Yes. Yes. If you're like me, you've noticed that getting older is full of little wake-up calls. You start seeing more hair in the drain, your part looks wider, and suddenly you're zooming in on old photos, wondering if your hair was always this thin. That's why I'm really loving what OneSkin is doing. Their OS01 peptide has been transforming our skin here at the Mona Charon Show for a while. Now, with their new scalp serum, OS01 hair, it's here to help us with hair loss, thinning, and shedding. Why would a skincare company create a scalp treatment? Well, because the scalp is skin, and just like the rest of your body, it experiences cellular aging. But instead of wrinkles, it messes with your hair follicles and natural growth cycle, leading to hair loss and thinning. OS1 hair is the first scalp serum powered by OneSkin's OS01 peptide, which targets those aging cells called senescent cells, and it's scientifically proven to help your hair cells do what they're meant to do. Grow denser, fuller, healthier hair. Get to the root of hair loss and thinning with OS01 hair. You'll save 15% on your first purchase with code MonaCharon at OneSkin.co. Anybody who knows me knows that I am really, I don't, you know, obsess about personal appearance, but two things I'm really into are healthy teeth and healthy hair. So this is very important to me. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code MonaCharon at OneSkin.co. That's 15% off at OneSkin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you.
What's next? I'll have to check. There's something about Beethoven. There was a movie, There's Something About Mary. Something about Beethoven. And we will have just a little taste of him, the final movement, a very fast movement from a string quartet of his in C major. I think this will be, I don't know, 2-3 minutes. And very exciting, very skillful. And we'll hear it played excitingly and skillfully by, I was going to say, a late American string quartet. They're not together anymore. The band has disbanded.
Okay.
But they are in recordings, the Emerson String Quartet.
Oh.
The ESQ. So
okay.
Here they are. Yeah. Fugal, you hear. It's fugue-like. Well, not a fugue.
Ah,
here we go.
Tapping.
It is. There's something about Beethoven.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
He reaches every human heart almost.
Almost. Yeah. In fact, in that book by Stefan Zweig, he does say, I mean, great lover of music, but he does say that Beethoven is his favorite.
Oh, does he? I hadn't read
that. Yeah, he does say that in the book. Yeah.
He just a little, I was looking at the notes here, just a personal note, if I may. So this recording, the Emerson String Quartet recording from Deutsche Grammophon, was produced by my friend Allison Ames, who for many years lived right down the hall from me.
Oh.
And she's now in a facility. And I just wanted to speak her name, my old friend Allison, who was quite something in the music business. She knew a lot of people. I met and conversed with Beverly Sills in her apartment, in Allison's apartment.
Oh, my goodness. Can I just ask you one question for the sake of people who might want to go to concerts, say they like this, and they think, I want to go to a classical music concert, but I don't know when to applaud, how to behave, like what to expect. What do you say to people like that? I mean, I say, just wait for when other people applaud, then you won't feel embarrassed. What do you think?
That's a good tip. I think most of the time people should applaud when they want to. But this is rather a long discussion. I've written quite a lot about it.
I know.
There are different protocols and different eras, but I don't think it should be a worry. People say to me, when should I applaud? How should I dress? And I usually say, just go and kick the tires. You know, just go and observe and see what you like. And
if hardly other people anybody whooping, dresses
whoop
anymore.
Away. Oh, yeah. As Chevy Chase once said in a movie, I resemble that remark.
People are in sneakers and hoodies and things nowadays at concerts.
Yes.
So
yes.
You don't have to worry about being underdressed.
Go as you are.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. A reader wrote me recently and said, can I wear like a blazer and slacks to the Met? And I said, you'll be the best dressed person in your section.
Right. Mm. It's always fun, though, to see. I always love seeing the students in the audience, you know, who are there with their scores and they're following along. I don't know. I just love that.
Because it speaks perpetuation to you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's going to continue no matter what. It's not dying.
It's unkillable. No.
Right, right.
As Charles Rosen, the late pianist scholar, said, the supposed death of classical music is perhaps the oldest tradition of classical music.
So what's next and why did you choose it?
Well, you know how they say on pop radio or rock radio, this is dedicated to? This one's dedicated to my friend Mona Charon, who mentioned it. Who mentioned the flower duet from Lakme, the opera by Delibes. It's a wonderful thing made popular by commercials, I think for British Airways. I think it's the so-called theme music of British Airways.
I didn't know that. I hate when they do that because then they overplay it, but whatever.
Well, it also introduces people to music.
I know.
I was thrilled to ringtones. In the early days, we had ringtones. For example, there'd be the Bach Badinerie. Yum, ba-da-bum, ba-da-bum, ba-da-bum. And I thought, God, why would Bach love that? That a tune of his was being played on these things called phones. I mean, I rather welcome it.
Okay.
I think another airline, United Airlines, I think they popularized Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
Rhapsody in Blue. No, see, but I hate that. I mean, it's just because I fly United all the time and I'm just, I'm oversaturated and I love that piece.
Well, also,
but I'm oversaturated.
You're an intellectual, Mona. You're an intellectual. Yeah.
No.
You ain't fooling nobody. Yeah.
No. Anyway. Okay.
Leo Delibes.
Yes.
Lakme, the famous flower duet. We're going to hear two French women. Some of us have been in love with them for many years, both of them. Sabine Duvier and Marianne Crabassa, soprano and mezzo-soprano. And such fine musicians and such fine singers.
And again, sorry, just to interrupt real quick, just explain the difference between a soprano and a mezzo-soprano.
One is higher. The soprano is higher.
Okay.
And the mezzo has, it's not necessarily a question of range, now that I've said that. It can also be a question of timbre.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And a soprano may well have a lighter, if you will, timbre, and a mezzo, a darker one. Now, this varies, but there are plenty of mezzos who can go way high. And mezzo-soprano literally means half a soprano, but as mezzos are the first to tell you, we're not half of anything. So here is that duet, the flower duet from Lacmé, the opera. This is the 1880s, written by the Frenchman, I'll say it in an English way, Leo Delibes. Wonder, I'd love to ask them, when a composer writes something like that, do they know they have a hit?
Yeah. And I wonder, when I listen to it, that makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I don't know why. I mean, it's just music strikes everybody differently. And that sometimes something just hits you. And it's just magical what it does to your brain and body. And I don't think that's just one of the mysteries of music, right? It is just...
Here's something just lightly technical. One of the things we're responding to in that duet, we're responding to the power of thirds.
Thirds.
The magic of thirds and sixths, which are really sort of the same thing. And they really please the ear.
They do. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a duet that this reminds me of that's in The Marriage of Figaro. Forget the characters' names now. But anyway, I listened to one not that long ago. It was Cecilia Bartoli singing with Renee Fleming. great pairing right there.
Yeah, that's a good combo.
Yeah,
darn good combo. And I thought we should have a taste of a different kind of opera, namely grand opera.
Okay, so explain.
People ask the question, what is grand opera?
There we go.
And you can use a lot of words, but it might be better to hear it. There is a grandeur about grand opera and majesty and also blood and guts, heart on the sleeve, emotion, letting it all hang out. Now, there are many, many tender, subtle moments within grand opera. But when people think of grand opera, they think of something like the duet we're going to hear. It's from Verdi's version of Shakespeare's Otello in Italian. And it's when Iago has really conned Othello. And now they're in cahoots, and Othello is bent on murdering his innocent and pure wife. And this is a kind of, sort of a fraternal duet. It's sort of a buddy-buddy, we're in it together duet. Very typical in opera, maybe in particular in grand opera. And we will hear two greats, namely the Swedish tenor Jussi Björling and the American baritone Robert Merrill, about whom I may say a little bit more later. But first, this duet by Verdi. Sangue means blood, I should say. This is Björling.
Per lo scuro mal sterminator, dire d'impeto tremendo. Resta qui anche svalgori, questa man che a Evo estendo.
Nel in cuore, questi
morti. Here comes Bob, Bob Merrill, Robert Merrill.
He's Iago.
Yep. Low voices tend to be bad guys.
Yeah.
They are up to no good.
No good at all. And that's a brief definition of grand opera. And swearing vengeance.
When they put surtitles in opera, it enhanced my appreciation so much more. Although a lot of the dialogue is pretty stupid, honestly. It's like, you know, when I was a kid, my parents always had the Texaco Metropolitan Opera broadcasts on in our house on Saturdays. So I was familiar with that. And I imagined that, you know, the lyrics were more poetry than, and then when they put the surtitles, I found out it's like, you know, I'm going down to the street now. No, please don't go. No, I go to the street. No, please don't go. And it's, you know, there's a lot of repetition.
You know, where titles really made a difference in the opera house, in comedies. People got the jokes.
Oh, yeah,
and,
sure.
And old timers, people who worked at the Met will tell me, before no one laughed except at broad physical humor.
Right,
you know,
right.
Falls and the like. And when titles came in, the house rang with laughter, which
sure.
was so nice, because there are, you know, a lot of clever and subtle jokes in these comedic operas.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's important.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. So,
let me tell you a quick something about Robert Merrill. He was part of a band of, I'll call them a band of, some of them didn't get along, but of New York singers. Richard Tucker, the tenor, was Reuben Ticker. His brother-in-law was also a tenor. They hated each other, unfortunately. Jan Pierce, who was Pincus Perelman. Beverly Sills, Belle Silverman. Roberta Peters, Roberta Peterman. That's very similar. But these New Yorkers made a huge success in opera. And in the middle of the century, or the late middle of the century, 20th century, they made a big difference in making America an opera-loving country in part. Big difference.
Well, I remember that when Sesame Street first became a big deal, what that might have been in the 70s or 80s, something like that.
Yeah.
I remember that Beverly Sills appeared on Sesame Street a number of times. And that was a great thing to introduce kids to
gospel
music.
Oh, she was so personable.
Yes, yes, yes.
She and Carol Burnett performed together. Marilyn
Great.
Horne and Eileen Farrell were on the Carol Burnett Show. You know, middlebrow culture was a thing. Today,
yes,
middlebrow culture would look impossibly high and snobbish.
It's true. Yeah, I could go on about that because I think the snobbishness goes the other way. It's assuming that, ordinary people won't be able to appreciate this kind of
I have
art.
long thought that anti-elitism is a bigger problem than elitism. This sneering at anything that isn't coarse, you know?
Exactly. And by the way, I mean, you grew up loving music because it was around you, right? It was nothing about you that was like, well, you have particular talent. You have perfect pitch, which most people don't have.
Exposure counts for a
But
lot.
exposure
A
counts for a
lot.
lot. And I was always struck by Venezuela, sort of pre-terrible Venezuela, but they had a program where they just put
El
instruments in the
sistema.
hand. Yeah, El Sistema, exactly. And they put instruments in the hands of all the kids, right? And so some of them turned out to be fantastic musicians, but all of them learned to love it, I would think, or nearly all.
I'll tell you a story. A friend of mine, a violinist, an American violinist from Wisconsin, went to Venezuela to help out El Sistema, and he came back and said, "You know, the kids who used to beat up us orchestra kids, they're in the orchestra there. Those kids
Oh,
are in the
that's great.
orchestra, the kids who used to beat us up."
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic. And I just in my when I get to rule the world, there will be an El Sistema in the United States.
You have my vote.
Thank you.
Well, on this podcast, is it a podcast? I don't know what to call
It
it.
is a
Well,
podcast.
it's the Mona Charon Show.
Yeah.
So there, one of us plays the cello, and it's not me, although my mother does. It's Mona Charon, and
Well, did.
we're gonna hear another American cellist born abroad, Yo-Yo Ma. Play with Itzhak Perlman, the violinist, the humoresque, just a delightful, a character piece by Dvorak, the great Czech. The humoresque played by Perlman and Ma with the BSO, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the late and great Seiji Ozawa.
Thank you.
Okay, I have three things I have to say right away. First of all, I am not a cellist. I played the cello for about 5 years, maybe 5 years ago or so. But anyway, I took it up for fun. I did play this piece, though, and I love this piece so much. I love Dvorak. And then I wanted you to elaborate on what you meant by, because I don't know this term. You said this is a character piece. What did you mean?
A character piece is a musical composition which is expressive of a specific mood or non-musical idea. This piece is meant to convey humor. And I'll have to look this up, but I believe there is a series of Dvorak humoresques, of which this is by far the most famous.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a piece in a certain mood, but as we can see, it's also sweet and a little melancholy.
Yes, you know. Yes, it's not just humor.
And no, it's versatile. But Dvorak did trouble himself to call it humoresque.
Yes. So anyway, one other quick story. So somebody that I know in a different context, I was chatting with, and we met. The topic of the cello came up. I happened to mention that I had played the cello in the past, and he it turned out, is really good friends with Yo-Yo Ma.
Mm.
And what do you know? But a few months later,
your colleague,
I got a note from Yo-Yo Ma, dear fellow cellist.
Thank you, Yo-Yo, for the backup.
It was wonderful. Oh, apparently, he is just a delightful human being, and reaches out to amateurs and all kinds of folks all the time, and does all kinds of humanitarian work. He's quite concerned about the state of our democracy, among other things. So he's just apparently a great citizen.
A rather well-known cellist told me that if it weren't for John Williams, Yo-Yo Ma would be the nicest person in music.
How about that? That's great.
They are both famous as princes. Princes. Both. Yeah.
Boy, and he can play that thing. All right.
Well, there was a man named Art Tatum, one of the great jazz pianists we've ever had, an extraordinary man, who awed all other pianists, including classical pianists. Vladimir Horowitz, for example, would haunt nightclubs in New York to hear Tatum, and once invited Tatum to his home because Horowitz had sort of memorized a Tatum improvisation. And Tatum said, well, you know, I wouldn't do it that way again, and sat down and did something completely different. But Tatum was really a great, and he wasn't completely blind. As I understand it, he had slight peripheral vision, and he could play cards with big, oversized numbers, and he could see the numbers out of a corner of his eye, I think. I can't remember. But an extraordinary, I want to use the word artist, a great piano technician, and also an extraordinary artist, as we will hear right now in his doing up of Dvorak's Humoresque.
Thank you.
here's the payoff right here. Only Tatum.
It's kind of a ragtime. Wonderful. Wow.
It's a little like Bach and Rachmaninoff, now that I think about it.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. A rendering that pays tribute.
I love that. That's a constant theme in music, you know, variations on a theme by this one or that one, where a composer will take a theme from an earlier composer and work it up, right?
Well, you have led beautifully into our next selection.
Okay.
It's not quite the same, but it's an homage. I guess some people say homage, right? We can pronounce the H in English. It's an homage in any way. In any case, from Ravel to Haydn, the year was 1909. It was the centenary of Haydn's death. And Maurice Ravel in France was asked to contribute to some project, I think, a piece in honor of Haydn. And he spelled out Haydn's name in a minuet. Now you say, how can you do that? Because A and D are notes, but not H and Y and N. Have I covered them all? I think I left one out.
Yeah.
There are ways. Different notes represent different letters. So he spelled out the name Haydn in this minuet, which is both sort of Haydn, and it's also a little Baroque, and it's also Ravel. And it's very, very brief. Ravel was an excellent economist, or an economizer, if you will. He never used a note more than necessary. He was an extraordinarily neat, tidy composer. And this, though it lasts only about a minute or so, it's really a great example of his art. And so let's hear it played now by the, I'll say more about him, by the young Korean pianist Seongjin Cho. And when I say his name on air and podcasts and so on, I always ask Koreans to forgive my pronunciation. Geniusly back to spelling the name.
I think I heard a story. It's been a while now, so I may be getting it wrong, but Robert Greenberg, who does these great courses tapes that on how to listen to and understand great music, and he's done others on, he's done opera, he's done different composers. Anyway, he's wonderful, really wonderful. And but I think he told the story that George Gershwin asked Ravel if he could come and take some lessons, and that Ravel said to him, "How much did you make last year?" And Gershwin told him, and Ravel said, "Well, maybe I should be taking lessons from you."
The way usually people usually tell this, Gershwin said $1 million.
Yeah, there you go.
We could look
Okay.
that up, but I don't know. But it would have been a lot.
Yeah, right.
Oh my, yes. And I do want to say something. Allow me to get on a soapbox for about 30 seconds about
Sure.
young Mr. Cho. He's born in the capital of South Korea. He goes to Paris to study with Michel Baroff at the conservatory there. Baroff is one of the great players of French Impressionism we have. Baroff's not too French a name, is it? And here comes this Cho, this Korean, who's one of the best French Impressionists in the world. And I just want to say that art doesn't have a gee damn thing to do with nationality or ethnicity or blood or soil. Not a freaking thing. I just want to say
Right.
that.
100%.
Whew. Sorry about that. Got a little emotional. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So, another Sergei Prokofiev, a great composer, a pantheonic composer, who wrote, we could talk about his symphonies, his piano sonatas, a cello piece for orchestra, the Symphonie Concertante. We could talk about operas, so many things. Violin sonatas and concertos, piano concertos. But there are two ballets, The Tower. And if his Romeo and Juliet, his Romeo and Juliet is the greatest work of art tied with the 100 other, 200 other greatest works of art. So we'll hear a brief excerpt, a famous excerpt from Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev, The Dance of the Knights, played by the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by the magnificent and late Lorne Mazel, a Pittsburgh kid and a very worldly fellow. So here's Prokofiev, Romeo and Juliet.
Maybe the reason I love that so much is that I saw it in concert one time, and I mean the brass, those tubas and trombones and trumpets, they just, your body vibrates when they play, right? I mean they are just, they blast you away.
So if you're Cinderella and the clock strikes midnight, that's bad news.
Yes.
That's bad news bears, baby. And you better skedaddle. And it's a big moment. It's chaotic when the clock strikes midnight. So let's hear this moment in Prokofiev's ballet, Cinderella, played by the Cleveland Orchestra again, this time conducted by a great pianist and a fine composer, Vladimir Ashkenazy. Cinderella at midnight.
Amazing that such majestic music can be paired with a fairy tale.
Yeah, those fairy tales. I don't intend to pun here, but those fairy tales have a lot of grimness in them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I thought we'd listen to a few American art songs, and written by personal friends of mine.
Great.
I thought people might appreciate that. Not long ago, I wrote an article about Mark Van Doren and his book about Shakespeare. Van Doren was a great literary scholar, Columbia University, up the street here, part of the famous and in part infamous Van Doren family.
Ah, which one was his? Was it his father who was the game show guy?
No, the game show guy was his son, Charles.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Who was repentant and lived a very honorable life.
Oh, good. Okay.
And was a formidable scholar, but not like his father, Mark. Mm-hmm. And his uncle, Mark's brother, Carl Van Doren, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his famous biography of Benjamin Franklin. But Mark Van Doren was a brilliant man, a poet, novelist, critic, anthologist. And after I wrote about Mark Van Doren, I heard from my friend Scott Wheeler, who said, you know, I wrote a song cycle to poems by Van Doren, a cycle called Serenata. And I thought we'd hear one of the songs. What's it called? If I Had a Wife. And for me, this is a wonderful match, really fitting, a match between words and music. And that, of course, is a lot of songwriting, doing that. So here is If I Had a Wife by Scott Wheeler to a poem of Mark Van Doren. And we'll hear the singer William Sharp, accompanied by Donald Berman.
If I had a wife, I would love her as kings loved queens in the old days.
Not wonderful.
Princess maiden.
They weren't so great in the old days.
Not all of them.
How do you do, my pretty? And all of that. If I had a wife, I would come home sometimes dressed like a stranger. And when she said, "Lady," I'd say, and woo her in wonder, how can there be such shining? And all of that. If I had a wife, I would never be done with remembering how it is now. When, oh, I am lonesome, and no one is here but my dog and my cat. Well, old boy's hungry, and all of that.
So, there's a composer named Daniel Asia. He's long worked at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's a friend of mine. He grew up in Seattle. He went to the same high school at the same time as
and Bill decided Gates. He'd had enough rain, so he moved to Arizona.
That is quite a contrast, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. He went to high school with Bill Gates and is the other man, Paul Allen, who founded Microsoft. Dan sometimes wishes they'd been better friends.
Yeah.
Dan wrote a song cycle called Breath in a Ram's Horn. And the words, certainly to this song, I'd have to check the whole cycle, are by the poet, the late poet, Paul Pines, a New Yorker. And this song is My Father's Name Was. And has a lot of flavor, as you can tell. So here's Daniel Asia. And let me get the performers of this baby. Robert Swenson, a tenor with an ensemble. So enough talking from me. Here we go. Dan Asia.
Father's name was Bernard. He screwed up in certain ways, but he was a good man, gave me what he could. My mother's name was Charlotte. She screwed up too, but carried me in her womb and afterward tried to keep in touch. My parents, Charlotte and Bernard, they fought but never apologized. Died young and left me behind, like a clue at the scene of a crime. Bernard and Charlotte, a long time dead and buried, I'm buried deep inside of me. I am their tomb, Charlotte and Bernard, my mother and my father, who laugh when I insist. My father's name was Bernard. My mother's name was Charlotte. These were my parents, Charlotte and Bernard. Bernard and Charlotte.
Wow, that's great.
Lee Hoiby once said to me, "It's my best song, you know." And I said, "Oh, no, it isn't, Lee." And I named three or four or five others. I said, "It's a big tie." And he said, "Okay." But he did say to me that "Goodbye, Goodbye World" was his best song. The words come from Our Town. Leontine Price often sang this song, as well as other Hoiby songs. She sang it, and this was recorded in her last recital in Carnegie Hall. But this song was not part of the ensuing album because the Thornton Wilder estate would not give its permission, which made Lee a little bit cross. But he was a wonderful composer. He's been gone a few years now. And Mona, since we speak personally sometimes, it's just us, he dedicated a song to me. Without ever having met me, because I wrote a piece about him.
And
he appreciated it. He appreciated it. And he sent me a manuscript in the mail. And it said at the top, you know, to J. Nordlinger.
Oh, that's so great.
And it's kind of a neat thing. I don't think I've ever mentioned this publicly. So, I mean, no one cares except me.
And wonderful. Wow.
And so, yeah. So this is Goodbye, Goodbye World. And it'll be sung by Julia Faulkner, an American soprano, with the composer at the piano. He was a fine pianist, taught by none other than Egon Petri, one of the greatest pianists of the 20th century, and a great teacher. But Lee decided he would become a composer. But he still played the piano right up to the end at a very high level. So here it is, Lee Hoiby, and allegedly his best song.
Is this Leontine Price? Who's singing?
Julia Faulkner.
Oh, okay.
That's very Lee. A little pop in there. Just a hint of pop. Very Lee, yeah.
Right here.
Okay, Jay, I'm going to take the privilege of being the host to ask you to talk about something that you have always shied away from talking about with me. Whenever I press you on it, you always find a way to change the subject. But I want to talk about perfect pitch. I'm really curious about this. It's one of those
gifts. That $7 will get you a latte at Starbucks.
Yeah, well, no, that's so that's not true. So you are a music critic. You can hear every deviation from the pitch that was intended. And so what I want to know does it enhance your appreciation of music, or is it sometimes a bother? Because, you know, like a soprano can maybe to me seem to be hitting the note, but you'll realize, oh no, she's a little sharp or she's a little flat. How does that translate into your appreciation for music?
Well, without getting too much into it, there's a difference between perfect pitch and relative pitch. Anyone can tell when a singer or other musician is a little off pitch, a little low, in other words, flat, or a little high, a little sharp. Perfect pitch is a different story. But intonation is that means you know what the note you know what a note is without knowing what another note is. In other words, if I played for you on the piano a D, you could probably sing G.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right, because of the placement. Yeah.
Exactly. Perfect pitch is knowing D without any help.
Right.
Yeah. But I'll tell you where it screws a person up. A couple of instances. You might hear something on the radio. Well, in the previous century, I listened to the radio. I haven't since. And you'll hear some transcription, and you'll know the music, but you can't quite tell what it is at first because it's just in the wrong key. You know? The other thing is, my friend Ron and I joke about this. At church, sometimes the organist will transpose hymns. So I'll be looking at the hymnal and the words, but the notes will be wrong in my mind because he's playing the hymn in a different key. And I find it very hard to sort of transpose on the fly, you know. And I'll say to him, Ron, you screwed me up again. And we laugh about it.
Okay. But are there times where you feel that it's a gift?
You know where it helps? Like you hear an encore and you're a music critic and you know the composer, but you can't think of what the key is. Sorry, you can't think of what the piece is, but you know the key. So you go home and Google and say, you know, blah, 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 and E flat minor, and it comes up.
There you go.
That is useful, but that is so minor, so darn minor.
Okay.
No pun intended with the word minor, I promise you. It's
Did you ever read Andre Previn, No Minor Chords?
Dear one, I suggested the book.
You're the one.
And you used to hail me. You used to thank me for recommending it. Have I ever read No Minor Chords? Mona Charon, have we met? I'm Jay Nordlinger, your friend from Michigan.
I am getting old.
As you can see, I'm not sensitive at all and I have very thick skin.
Okay. So for all of our viewers and listeners, please read this book. Andre Previn, great composer, conductor, Hollywood composer, husband of Mia Farrow.
Husband of five. Thank you very
husband
much.
Husband of five. That's true.
Anyway, Mutter, Dori Previn.
Okay. Yeah. Mm. Anyway, he wrote one of the best and funniest memoirs I've ever read. Thanks to Jay Nordlinger, we knew about it.
Yeah, the better. That's better. Thank you. You used to credit me with this, but you know, how quickly they forget, you know.
Yeah. My brain's a sieve. What can I say? But my brain has been given a treat today with this music and having you. It's always great to see you and to talk to you.
I'm glad you exist, Mona Charon. I've read you since the 80s. I've read you since the 80s. And you give me great comfort and illumination, and you're...
Likewise.
One of the greatest gifts a writer can give another is to make the reader feel less alone.
Yeah. And we do that for each other.
Well, I wanted to end with Philip Glass, who's maybe the most famous composer of today. Violin Concerto No. 2, nicknamed the American Four Seasons. This is the last few minutes of the last movement. It's in a long tradition of violin playing, violin writing, as I think you may hear. And it's awfully good. And thank you, Mona Charon. We're going to hear the Polish violinist Piotr Plawner with the Bern Chamber Orchestra conducted by Philippe. Get this, his last name is Bach, Bach, B-A-C-H. How about that? So this is Philip Glass, and thank you, dear Mona Charon.
Thank you, Jay. I'm so glad we played the Bach earlier, because that's a little Bachian.
Almost everything can be traced back to that man. Almost nothing would be novel to Bach. He includes everything that came before him and everything that would come after him. I'll quote Mona Charon. Many years ago, we were talking in a podcast, and she said, "There's Shakespeare and there's Bach." Now, I'm not comparing myself, but I am a writer, you said, so I sort of get Shakespeare, even though I'm not Shakespeare. But Bach, therefore, I consider him the greater. I don't know what your opinion would be today, but that's what you said at the time, and I've quoted you many times.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Gosh, you also have a eidetic memory or something. I don't know. As you can see, I forget everything.
But I just pay attention to what you say.
I will never forget this podcast. And what a joy.
Thank you, dear one. Thank you for being you. Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.